listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. It's so wonderful to have you along. We've got a regular and very much loved guest, Phyllis Titchenin. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning, Rodney. Good morning, everyone else.
I feel as though I should have a nickname for you. I've got my Professor Gardening Guru, Wally Richards. I've got Dr. Sarah Farrant. And we need a title for you. You're sort of like a, we can't call you Professor Guru because we've got one, but I'm going to have to work on that for you because you're such a wonderful font of knowledge.
Well, thank you. It's feels wonderful to be helpful, to be able to contribute what I've picked up over the years. And all I can say to people is information is out there. You just need to apply yourself to looking for it and doing some study. Don't ever stop studying. That's my motto. Yeah. Keep learning.
I've got two questions for you before we get into today's topic. And it's, how did you come across Western A Prize?
Probably about 20 years ago, someone mentioned to me that they had just the you know, his name got mentioned with regards to nutrition. And because I've already been quite concerned and on an alternative to the American, the standard American SAD diet of white bread and Hostess Twinkies and Coca-Cola, which thankfully I wasn't raised on, I had been interested in nutrition for a long, long time. And I, by the second time I heard it, I thought, now I really need to look into this. And I think back on it that the thing that really propelled me to look was that Kay Baxter, the Heritage Seed lady who now has a farm in Gisborne, when I was visiting her in 2005 or 2006, she showed me a cookbook, the Nourishing Traditions cookbook.
Oh, yes. The
and I thought, wacko. I admire Kay and all she's doing in the realm of heritage seeds. And I was there talking with her about biological agriculture and the emphasis on nutrient density in our plants and the way we raise our crops. And she was the one who showed me the book. And I went right out and bought it and was really delighted with the combination of good from scratch, straightforward, tasty recipes with little sidebars of science.
Yes.
and great tips throughout. And it's been you know, a major reference go-to cookbook for me ever since.
It's a wonderful gift.
Mm. Yeah. I bought, when I bought my first one, I turned around and I bought two more so that I had them in the bookshelf ready to go when my two children finally, you know, needed a cookbook.
Yes.
So that's, you know, the cookbook I gave them as the, here's a basic be healthy guide for your cooking.
Now, we had an interesting interview on my show with a Dr. Alirizi Panipour. I'm sure I've done his name a disservice. People don't listen to me for correct pronunciation, I'm afraid. But Dr. Alirizi is a dentist in the United States, and he describes himself as a conscious dentist. He's Zoroastrian, originally from Persia. As a young boy, he escaped with his family. I picked up carriage as we were going through this interview, and I said, oh, what did you make of Western A. Prize? He said, the greatest. And he said he was 100% right. And I said, well, you must be in trouble with your colleagues. Oh, he said, they try and defrock him and decertify mm-hmm. him and do everything to him.
Yeah. I found it interesting that several mentions that the Dr. Weston A. Price's major book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, it's a doorstopper, published in 1939, by the mid-40s, late-40s, 50s, through about the early 60s, it appears, at least in the United States, it was required reading. It was on the reading list for most upper division anthropology courses.
Oh, really?
Yes, in U.S. universities, because it was a scientific exploration, science-based overview of tradition, the value and the science, the modern science justification of traditional wisdom. And, you know, the notion that there are people all over the world who are primitive or tribal or whatever we want to call them or they were called at the time, they were so in touch with their environment that they understood what it took to eat in such a way and behave in such a way that they could thrive for millennia without a lot of inputs, if you will, from other places. They weren't, you know, they weren't flying in food from Mexico in winter. They were sustaining themselves, and not only were they sustaining, they were thriving, and they were in better health with better diets than people even in the 1930s in the United States. This, I think, is what blew Price away. He was agog that literally
anyone who
they're getting better food.
Anyone who reads the book is agog. And I love Western civilization. I love progress. I love technology. But it's recognizing the downsides and learning about the massive downsides and learning how to have, if you like, our cake and eat it. Because that's exactly what we lost, isn't it? We just went... We industrialized our manufacture of transportation with cars, but we did the same bloody thing to our food. Mm. And that was the mistake.
You hit on a really important point there, Rodney. And it is, I think, the difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Yes.
When we develop scientific knowledge, when we, in quotes, discover things from a science perspective, we tend to feel that we're the only people who know this. We are the first ones to develop it or to realize it without giving not only due credit to ancient or older or other civilizations who are already using this information in their practices or in their diet. Mm. And as a result, they're very strong. So what happened with Price and the discovery of vitamins in the 1920s onwards was suddenly scientists were using microscopes and chemical titration and isolation to find these, what to them were new compounds, and labeling them vitamins A, B, C, D, E, what have you. And then they figured that they could then synthesize those vitamins chemically and put them into people's diets, and then everyone would have everything they needed and be healthy. It didn't work that way. It still hasn't worked that way. And that's a major tenet of the Weston A. Price Foundation's approach to nutrition is getting it in its full natural form from your food is the ideal way that nature has designed you to receive your food inputs from the environment. We weren't designed and haven't evolved to, you know, to have synthetic inputs you know, in varying amounts. It's meant to be in healthy, unpolluted, nutrient-dense with food with, you know, a minimum of processing or processing that actually unlocks naturally more of those, more of our bodily access to nutrition at things like fermenting fruits or vegetables or soaking grains. Those natural processes that have been used for millennia in really differing cultures around the world, they not only had the knowledge, they might not have understood it from our standpoint to be able to explain the chemical processes going on, but they had the wisdom to see over millennia that it made their food more accessible. It made it more valuable and useful to them. So they continued those traditions. They may not have had the science knowledge, but they did have the wisdom to observe what we call empirical experiments and to continue to use those practices to their benefit. Whereas a lot of science in the last 100 years or more has been glorifying knowledge without really paying attention to a more holistic wisdom of how to apply that in such a way that everyone benefits.
It's such an interesting thing because it's, and of course, presumably those societies that didn't eat properly didn't survive, but it's such an interesting thing because you got to go above science in a way to a higher level to look at it, don't you? Because I think of myself when I was young, and I thought of myself as a mechanism, you know, like as a, I could have been a robot. And if something wasn't working right, there'd be a pill to take and you'd come right, or an injection to take and you would come right. And likewise for food, in a science fiction way, I imagine you'd get to the point where you'd just open a packet and that would be your food for the day, right? And funny enough, that simplistic view, you realize, is behind modern healthcare and modern nutrition. And it really is that simplistic. Oh, you need this many proteins, this many carbohydrates, get your macros right. Oh, you'll need some minerals, get that right, you'll be fine. Oh, don't overdo the fat, it'll kill you. Go to see the doctor, you're not well, go and see the doctor, he'll diagnose you, he'll write you a script, and you'll take a pill. And we go through this, and it's so silly because the one thing that's happened with science is the complexity of the living world and our bodily interaction with it has grown astronomically with our understanding.
And yet, one, does it actually give us wisdom and veneration and a holistic viewpoint? An acceptance of the complexities of life. One point, I doubt that it does for the most part. Second point is to ask, and how is that approach working for us?
Yes. But of course, you and I know there's science that's bought and paid for by governments and corporations. And there then there's science.
We tend to lose sight of the history of science. And
yes,
anyone who dabbles in science or who has a science degree or really ought to take a decent course in the history and philosophy of science.
Mm.
It didn't start out as linear and reductionist and controlled by moneyed interests. It tends to be today. It was, you know, unleashing people from what was said to be the, you know, controlling, narrowing strictures of the church to control people's belief, or to sort of shut down their whole willingness or joy and wonder and awe of the natural world. And out of that schism, that break from the stricture of the churches on any alternative form of thinking or observation was the beginning of the Enlightenment. And that notion that we could look at the world with a sense, without the blinders on, asking any questions you want, without it being heretical or forbidden. It was meant to be an all-ranging, ask any questions, let it be as complex as it is, and embrace that complexity. It's gotten narrower and narrower and more controlled and more like religion all the time. I mean, or over the last 400 or 500 years. So
it's a funny thing, because I studied at university economics and biology and environmental science. And looking back on it, there was a tendency, especially in economics of all things, that they had this classical view of what science was, which was classical physics. So you'd have these billiard balls, and you'd hit a billiard ball, and you could write an equation following Newton to describe the exact movement of that billiard. And they thought they could do that for economics. And they'd come up and they'd measure this and they'd measure that and they'd build these models. And in many ways, it was very similar in parts of biology, and certainly in the technical side of biology, where you'd be looking at what nutrients were needed and all the rest of it. But of course, economic and biology are systems, the complexity of which we're only dimly perceiving. And dear Isaac Newton himself knew how limited his understanding was in such a beautiful passage near the end of his life. And of course, physics went on at the early part of the 20th century to become weird in terms of its understanding. And that's what we're, in a way, learning, isn't it? That when you are growing a plant, it's not just the correct nutrients, it's the living soil.
And a lot of that is physics. It's actually about energy flow. We literally can measure the flow of electrons, of energy, in the soil solution, the nutrient broth, if you will, that is part of the soil. And if there's no flow of electrons, there's no movement of nutrients, and there probably a whole bunch of other physics-based considerations having to do with water and its amazing properties. But ultimately, we are not thinking complexly enough. We are wanting to simplify a complex system, and it simply does not work in the long run. And it doesn't work in the agricultural example for actually creating food that's worth eating, that is nutrient dense and spray free, and actually helps us to maintain and build strong bodies.
You have a vision for New Zealand.
Yes, I do.
Share it.
My vision is that New Zealanders are the healthiest, longest living, happiest, most connected to their environment people on the planet. And my thinking is that this, because we are an agricultural nation now, and we are orienting, have been orienting for a while, our narrative about what we produce as the food basket of the world from a very elite, high quality narrative. We ourselves need to understand how to actually do that in a way that makes our environment better, that cleans up the water, that restores the soil, and more than just having a narrative about clean, green New Zealand. We do agriculture in such a way that we have next to no synthetic inputs. We have lowered costs for farmers, but we're actually verifiably delivering food with more vitamins and more minerals, more embodied energy and nutrient density than consistently than any other agriculture or food exporting country. We can absolutely do that. We can measure those things now, but we're not. And the major reason we're not pushing that in New Zealand, my opinion, is because the way we're currently doing agriculture with a chemical support service system, if you will, is we are not achieving nutrient density. We're still using poisonous compounds, pesticides, herbicides, and synthetic fertilizers on our food. And as a result, we're not getting the verifiable flavor profiles, vitamin and mineral levels that are possible and that our markets are demanding. So I think we're kind of skirting around this issue of quality and actually measuring it, because we're afraid of what we'll find and what we'll have to change as a result of finding that we're not actually producing the world's best food. We can and we should, but we have a ways to go. Good news is we know how to do that.
So you could imagine being an apple grower or lettuce grower and just switching your system to, what would you call it, regenerative, soil-rich, nutrient-dense food?
Well, I prefer to call it organic regenerative.
Organic regenerative, okay. And then selling those, that produce, into the world's markets to those people who recognize its value, which is medicine.
Absolutely. Or you should be, it's, you've been consistently eating nutrient dense, natural, you know, unprocessed, cook it yourself ideally, food for so long that you don't need medicine.
No, that's right. Your food is your medicine.
Your food.
I just got an email from my gardening guru, Wally Richards, and he was saying how great it is to grow your own potatoes and many shorter potatoes. He goes in and he said he can't eat, and he's very careful with money, Wally. He can't eat the potatoes that you buy at the supermarket, and he has to pay three times the price to get decent potatoes. But he said he pays it.
I mean, the good thing is, even without the metrics and the measurements and the little devices for, you know, figuring out nutrient density and vitamin and mineral content, which have existed and are being refined, you know, we need to use our best meter for flavor, and that's our taste buds and the way our bodies actually respond. I remember the first time I was on a marae in New Zealand. It was the opening of a whare kai in the King Country, and I had a dish of karengo, seaweed, sort of, you know, shoved towards me. Try this. You haven't tried this. And I looked pretty gloopy and weird and kind of greeny gray. And I thought, okay, smile and pretend you're enjoying this. And I had a mouthful, and it was like the hallelujah chorus. It's like my taste buds just went ballistic, and it was as though my whole body was kind of elevated 2 inches off of my chair. It was a full body response to the nutrition that was in that seaweed. I remember it very plainly as an indication that our bodies know what's good for us. If we haven't too much polluted them or turned them off or are too sick, we're like animals. We have an innate sense of what is medicinal or what is healing or what is nutritional for us. We just kind of perverted those tastes by ultra-processed food over the last 50 years. But, you know, we know in daring that cows will choose, if given a choice, will choose a variety of pasture plants. Many of them are the ones that we consider weeds, but they know what they need. It doesn't take a lot. It's a little bite of plantain, a little bite of this thistle over here. All of them have something to add. I mean, there is even a word for animals knowing what they need to eat for medicine. And the word is, wait for it, zoopharmacognosy.
Oh, wow.
Zoopharmacognosy.
So they're cognizant.
Animals. Animals for the zoo, pharma for the medicine or pharmaceuticals, and cognosy for the Latin root for knowing. So zoopharmacognosy, we're animals. We know too. We just need to pay more attention and maybe clean out our palates a little bit.
I have gone from being terrified of hens to loving them. And I love watching my hens because they know exactly, they must have a brain the size of a pea. But man, they know what they need.
Yes, yes.
And you'll give them some food and they'll turn their nose up it and then they'll go for something else that's protein they need today, say. Now we're going to talk breakfasts, get down to the nitty gritty. I love that discussion. And thank you for sharing your vision. It's a wonderful one.
And we can do this. We need to do this for not only our own health, but our own economic stability and independence. And so the farmers actually get the acknowledgement, the veneration, and the help that they need to understand the crucial role that they play, not only in human health, you know, through nutrition, but in environmental health as well. Mm. You know, farming can be a restorative process for the environment. That's what we need to focus on, those two goals, nutrient density and restoration.
Tell us about breakfast.
Well, I think to start off with the word breakfast. Have you ever broken it down? It means breaking the fast that you've been on all night since the last meal you had, usually dinner. And yes, there are all sorts of, more awareness for some people, intermittent fasting, the idea of skipping breakfast so that your body has more time to digest food and access fat reserves to lose weight if you want to do that. All well and good, but there are groups of people who really do need food right away when they wake up. And the major one of those is children. Or, for example, people who are going to be doing a great deal of physical labor and can't wait for that muffin and coffee break at 10 o'clock because they will run out of fuel if they have the standard breakfast of champions, so to speak, which for many people, and unfortunately these days for children, which is a highly processed, puffed up, nutrient deficient breakfast cereals. Okay, so, don't know about naming names, but you all know what I'm talking about. The stuff that's in the supermarket comes in a cardboard box. And as you mentioned before, there's the distinct possibility that the cardboard of the box is ultimately more nutritional than the contents. I haven't really found a good science backing for that.
Including the plastic bag.
Yeah, I won't go into that too far because I can't back it up, but I've heard that from many sources. But a poor breakfast that basically includes things like, admittedly, you know, wheat bix or shredded wheats, and usually low-fat milk, you know, greenwood milk, and orange juice. You have no quality fats. You have a lot of sugar. I made an effort to look up some of the levels of sugar in breakfast cereals, and basically what it comes down to is 50% or sometimes more of the carbohydrates, that's sort of the total value of that, is actually sugar. So this is
I remember doing that one day when I was, you know, learning all this stuff. And like a kid's breakfast would have 25 or 30 teaspoons of sugar.
Yes, yes.
And now, in the entire bloodstream, they have one teaspoon.
Right. 5 grams of sugar is what normally circulates in your bloodstream without causing you to, you know, go into hyperglycemia or to basically head you down the path of prediabetes or insulin resistance. Because if you get too much blood, too much sugar dumped into your blood at one time that exceeds that 5 grams of circulating glucose or sugar, your body considers this an emergency, and it releases insulin from your pancreas in an effort to, in effect, and this is putting it all simply, but force the sugar into your cells to get it out of your bloodstream, because too much sugar is an emergency. It's not a, your body does not view lots of sugar flavorably. It's toxic.
And of course, the sugar goes straight from your gut to your bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So these little kids
are
having their system overwhelmed. Then what we know happens is the insulin shoots up, the sugar gets dragged out of the bloodstream, deposited as fat, it overcorrects because survival is the key thing at this point. 2 hours later, the sugar has all been removed from the bloodstream, too much sugar, and the kid's hungry. He's deposited fat, and he's hungry.
And so he can't focus or concentration, sugar cravings, disruptive behavior, and basically what, you know, what schools are trying to teach them simply doesn't lodge. Their brains, you know, are somewhere else. But you see this all the time with adults as well. And it's the, you know, the more coffee and muffin at 10 a.m. We shouldn't need to eat that frequently, and we certainly shouldn't, you know, try to compensate for the sins of having a high sugar breakfast by adding more sugar to it. So what do we need for a good breakfast is the question. And I say we need nutrient-dense food that actually fuels our bodies in a balanced way, and allows especially children and pregnant mothers and people with high exercise, if you will, jobs to actually last through to breakfast without a dip in blood sugar or a lack of concentration. So the typical poor kiwi breakfast choices, we've talked about that. So what are some good choices for breakfast? And really, it's going back to what were our grandparents eating for breakfast? And they were eating high fat and reasonably high protein breakfasts. And if you go even further back through the Scottish porridge line, you will find that they were eating grains, but these grains were soaked or fermented so that the more of the nutrition was actually accessible to us. And those grains weren't contaminated with glyphosate that had been sprayed on them as a desiccant or a dry down just before they were harvested. So we need for, you know, I really want to emphasize that children, if we're sending children off to school with a dried cereal and milk breakfast, we're impairing their ability to learn or to socialize well. So once again, I would suggest that we actually look at the old two eggs and a sausage, or a couple of eggs in any form, with butter or with bacon or with blood pudding, or even going so far as to have lamb's fry and bacon and onions, but putting effort into a hot breakfast that truly nourishes is the most excellent way of making sure that children not only have a good start to the day and do better at school, but they're building their bodies all the time. It's almost impossible to do that properly on dry cereal. Okay. So I'm not against smoothies, but I think for most children, having eggs in some form in the morning is pretty important. I wish they weren't so expensive. I strongly recommend, you know, as you've done, grow your own hens, or to look for organic grass-fed eggs. There is a difference in quality. There is a difference in flavor. And unfortunately, there's also quite a big difference in price. But ultimately, it's worth it to get eggs as the perfect food with yolks, which are excellent packages of fat-soluble vitamins.
You're a big fan of the egg yolk.
I'm a big fan of egg yolks. I recommend other people do this, but I know my local growers. I trust them. They are organic. They are free range. And I use raw yolks, their raw yolks, in my smoothies. It's not something I recommend for, you know, the normal run of conventional eggs. You do need to be cautious about salmonella in many conventional egg settings. But you should also, we tend to overcook our egg yolks. Eggs, like many fragile, very valuable nutritional packets, if you overcook them, they will start to, the proteins and the other more fragile compounds, like some of the fats, will lose their potency. They will lose some of their value. Egg yolks are particular that way. You want to try to eat them ideally heated through, but still runny.
Mm. Okay? I'm going to shoot off at a tangent because I read that likewise, and you'd be able to correct me, for bone broth, that you don't want to overcook your bone broth because the protein structures break down.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's the same for the yolk.
Absolutely. And the yolk is even more delicate in terms of the nutritional compounds that are in there.
Oh, I'm going to have to, my little girl likes her eggs solid.
Try gently ooching over to less and less.
One of my girls still has the Great Sally Fallon's smoothie for weaning a child off mum's milk, and she's 13.
There you go.
So she has a raw egg, kefir, bone broth, and a banana mixed up, chonk, that's her breakfast, rain or shine, winter or summer. And I must say to anyone, I'm the best example because I hated hens, and I've got hens, and I said to my wife, I said, I can't imagine now not keeping hens.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much cheaper, so much tastier, and not a lot of work, no work
mm-hmm.
compared to going to the supermarket even. And I feel as though I could survive. It's one of those things that you think, oh, well, if things came to the trouble, you've got eggs.
If the S hits the fan,
yes.
Hens are a great way to go. I mean, I have a little caveat on that. If you want the full value, this full optimal nutritional value in the egg, particularly in the yolk, they need to have access to, you know, green
yes.
growing plants. It doesn't have to be pasture, but pasture is an example. It's yes. very important that they get out and to be able to, once again, engage in zoopharmacognosy
yes.
and eat what their body tells them they need. But like cows, if they don't have access to the chloroplast in green grass, they are not going to have the same level of fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E in their milk in the case of cows or in their egg yolks in the case of hens. Everybody needs to be out there, you know, having access to green grass, green plants, in order to truly have optimal nutrient density in your animal foods.
What's your view of toast?
Sorry, of what?
Toast.
Toast.
I'm not saying toast only for breakfast,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't mention having your poached eggs on sourdough toast with dripping butter.
Toast is a fine thing, as is bread in moderation. I don't like to see it be, you know, 50 to 60% of your volume of consumption is standard white bread. But once again, it's the what actually went into that bread? And was it, you know, created in an ultra-fast process that really didn't involve any pre-soaking or fermenting, in which case it's very fast carbohydrates. It's be easily turned into sugar and give you a huge sugar boost and rush and a push down the path of diabetes that you probably don't want to go down there. So having increasingly here, we're able to get something besides just, and I don't want to say just because Bogle's was a real eye-opener for me when I first came to New Zealand. And, you know, they were all that was available that was even vaguely whole yes. grain to begin with. There are lots more, you know, options now, but ultimately anything that you can kind of wad up with your hands and it becomes smaller, to me, that's not really a bread you want. It's mostly air and it's mostly sugar. So you want ideally mixed grains that are organic in origin, so they haven't been sprayed. They're more likely to have higher vitamin and mineral content, that have been pre-soaked and truly fermented for a good 24 plus hours to liberate the nutrition that is in the grains. And that's a long conversation about why we pre-soak grains and why this is part of traditional wisdom to pre-soak grains. So won't go there, but just if you're going to eat porridge, do it the old Scottish way, which was to have your, you know, your bowl or your container of porridge, you'd put, you know, good quality water on it. You'd maybe add a little whey or a little lemon juice, and you would leave it at least overnight, and then ideally drain it, and then cook it, so that you actually get better nutrition out of it that way, and you eliminate some of the enzyme inhibitors that are keeping the grains from releasing their vitamins or particularly their minerals to us when we eat it.
Because they essentially start to germinate.
Yes, there's a whole process when water comes in contact through the outer layer of the grain or the seed itself, it will start to release enzymes that prompt the seed, the little germ inside the seed, to wake up and start to grow. And when that process happens, that's when a whole series of other cascades happen that unlock access, if you will, or availability of the magnesium, the calcium, and even some of the proteins and trace elements that are locked up in that seed, waiting to be the first several weeks or days of the meal for that little tiny germ of a plant that's just germinating inside that seed. So it's the packed lunch for that new baby plant before it's, you know, while it's getting its roots down into the soil so it can access minerals and its leaves up into the sunshine so that it can photosynthesize and create energy. And, you know, the seed compacts those minerals into the smallest possible package. So there's a locking up process that goes on that unless we pre-soak and to a certain extent ferment our grains, they're not only going through us without releasing most of their minerals, other than giving us a fair amount of sugar, they also have compounds on them that can grab onto minerals in our small intestine or in our large intestine and pull them out of circulation, and then we poop them out and they're lost as well. So soaking grains is pretty important, and traditionally that is what most cultures did. We've just forgotten. Congee, which is the Chinese and to a certain extent Japanese rice soup for breakfast, those were all pre-fermented. Porridge is fermented. And beans and other seeds are all fermented. You remember the childhood little verse about peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in the pot 9 days old. They were fermenting peas. So they're, you know, the back of the stove or the back of the fireplace, so that, you know, they not, I mean, you have to be careful about peas that have been outside of refrigeration for 9 days. But you get the idea. It would take a multiple day process to make food from seeds because they need to be pre-soaked and to a certain extent fermented.
How would you recommend a parent listening in to shift their habits from Weet-Bix to soaked grains, eggs, sausages, bacon, butter, lamb's fry, because we are, particularly when it comes to food, creatures of habit. So the parents have to change their behavior in the morning. Then they have to change the kids' expectation of breakfast.
One way of doing that, I think, is kind of backing into it as a treat. I mean, a lot of families that I know will do waffles or pancakes or muffins or quiche, you know, for special weekend breakfast or brunch. Okay. There, you can. That's where I suggest parents make the extra effort to start easing those sorts of higher fat, higher protein foods into the normal breakfast routine. Okay. There are a couple of really good recipes on the Weston A. Price website. One of them is for traditional soaked porridge. One of them is for, is this one, for smoothie. One of them is for pancake or waffles with organic pre-soaked grains, eggs, melted butter, and a little bit of sweetener like rapadura or muscovado sugar, so brown sugar, or some kind of fruit preserve. And you make them up and you keep them in a container in the refrigerator. So you don't have to, it's like the pot of porridge at the back of the stove, except it's your waffle or pancake mix in an airtight container in the refrigerator that you can bring out that will last for several days. And there you have a treat that it, because of the eggs, because of the melted butter, you have something that has good levels of enduring fat and protein for fueling kids throughout the day. And they can add additional butter on top, never too much butter, or lard or coconut oil or some kind of low fruit or low sweetener jam or yogurt, or bust the bank and go for real maple syrup, you know, feijoa jam or fresh fruit salad. It's those wonderful sorts of things. You know, there are ways of making it easier to do. And I would start adding sausages in. If nothing else, most kids like sausages, and they're not wildly expensive, and they have both protein and fat. You do ideally want to get ones that don't have a lot of, you know, spice mix or preservative in them. But if you got to start somewhere, sausages are a good combination of protein and fat for most kids.
We know this for ourselves, that if we go off to work with two Weet-Bix and trim milk and an orange juice, we're going to be hungry by morning tea. But if we have a lovely porridge that was soaked, or we have, and we have, or we have eggs, sausages, bacon, sourdough bread, lashes of butting, we can just head off and sail through the day. And I don't know whether it's psychological, but you're happier.
I think it's, yes, it's psychological. There's nothing wrong with that, because your psychology is definitely connected to your physiology. And a lot of that is really about what we're eating, the quality of the fuel that we're putting into our bodies. You can have all sorts of options, including smoothies like your daughter uses, you know, using cream, preferably egg yolks or eggs. You can put coconut oil or ghee and fruit and vitamin C or acerola powder. You can add mushroom powders to it. It absolutely is, it can be a powerhouse. But just in terms of really powering kids through, if you're going to do, you know, egg yolks in a smoothie, they probably need at least two. Yes. I use 4 to 5 egg yolks, just the yolks, with full cream and ghee and coconut oil and fruit in my smoothie. And trust me, it powers me until nearly dinner time. So
that is, Adam, that would be, what, 85% fat?
Yes. Nothing wrong with 85% fat.
Nothing.
If it's good quality fat, if it's saturated animal fat from grass-fed chickens or beef. And I mean, here's where I'll briefly make a plug for raw milk.
No.
It's another big topic, but if you, I mean, we are the land of dairy cows, you know, look for, you know, your local dairyman and ask if he would be willing to allow you to come every week or two and pay him for taking several gallons of milk.
Yes.
And using
You pay him
using
a lot
that.
More than Fonterra.
Absolutely. And it's, we shouldn't, we are very clean producers of milk. Mm-hmm. This whole notion that, you know, your lactose intolerance, I think, is a myth. I know a lot of people who react to pasteurized milk. I only know one person who genuinely reacts to raw milk. Usually, if the milk is raw, you have all of the enzymes and all of the vitamins still in there. And the major enzyme still in there is lactase. And it's the lactase that digests the lactose.
The very process of pasteurizing it destroys the lactase.
Destroys the lactase so that you do have difficulty digesting the lactose because you don't have its companion enzyme that is meant to be there, even for baby calves, to break down the milk in the gut.
You get a funny one from people when you talk about milk being good for you, and they say, milk, it's meant for calves, baby calves, not adults. And you're saying, every food on the planet that we eat is meant for something else. I mean,
where do we belong?
Yeah, like eggs, meat, you know, an animal's not producing meat for you to eat. You have subverted it. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because milk is built for mammals.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think you could make the argument that fermented milk is more along the lines of what in ancient times or traditional cultures would have used. We would have extracted the cream and made it into butter or ghee, or we would have fermented it into yogurt or fermented it into cheese because we didn't have refrigeration back there or easy refrigeration. So yes, you can make an argument for we didn't have a lot of fresh milk, but there are lots of healthy cultures out there who have traditions of eating kefir or kefir and liquidy yogurts. And ultimately, when milk is fermented, it is more stable and less likely to go off. That's what cheese is. You know, cheese is milk's leap towards immortality. You know, you're changing something that's liquid and will go off into a compound that doesn't need a great deal of refrigeration and can last for months or years.
Phyllis, we're truly blessed to have you with us. We love your vision for New Zealand. Thank you for telling us about your journey in Western A Prize. But breakfast, I think what we're going to have to do next is lunch, particularly kids' lunch. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. I've been talking to Phyllis Titchener. Oh, gosh, isn't she wonderful? She is so amazing. Thank you, Phyllis. Thank you so much for sharing your morning with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.